date is December 7, 2007, and we are at the Atlantic Coast Bank, 715 Center Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing William Arthur Yantis, born August 12, 1942, in Kansas City, Missouri. My name is James McCannell, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Frank Reidinger, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Bill, tell us how you first got involved with military service.
My name is Bill Yantis. I first got involved in military service by attending Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, that had an ROTC program. 2 years, the first 3 years was compulsory, the second 2 years was voluntary. So in the fall of 1960, I entered ROTC and commenced my exposure in that fashion. We had class 2 times a week, drill every Friday afternoon from 1 o'clock to about 4 o'clock. And I remember spending an awful lot of Thursday evenings with the smell of brasso and black shoe polish as I put a very high luster on my low cuts, because the polished brass and very shiny shoes were a critical way to get ahead in the Army at that point. I'll tell you a little bit more about the ROTC experience.
Okay.
I was enthusiastic about it, but I wasn't the best student initially. I remember being pulled aside by the platoon leader and having him give me some special instructions on complicated maneuvers like left face, right face, about face. My feet didn't work quite as well as I would have hoped they would, but I did get better. The freshman year was largely given over to military history, and it's something I've always had a real profound interest in. And as a consequence, my grades were high, and my grades in drill got better with the passage of time. So consequently, when the sophomore year came around, it was announced that I would be one of the battalion sergeants major. There was a brigade sergeant major who was a sophomore, and then two sophomore sergeants major for battalions, and I was one of them. It was a lot of fun to see leadership in that sense, kind of a close-up situation where I didn't have an awful lot of responsibility, but one of my chief concerns was to caution the battalion commander to make sure that the battalion had a proper facing movement before he gave him a forward march command. So that was the most important thing I think I did in drill. I went to summer camp in the summer of 1962. We went to Fort Riley. Fort Riley was then the home of the 1st Division, probably still is, and they were the unit that provided all the training facilities that we used. The ROTC program was located at what was then called Camp Funston, which was right beside I guess it's a Kansas River. Allegedly, the barracks that we stayed in, which were World War II, would burn down in 10 minutes. At least that's the story we had, and I think probably everybody in the Army had some kind of legend associated with the facilities that they had. Fort Riley was very hot. It was not a dry heat, regardless of what they told us. It was humid. We'd get up bright and early in the morning and work all day long. Cadet Officers Club was welcome, though, and the 3-2 beer was not bad. I had a good summer camp. I was in Company K. I was awarded the Distinguished Military Student as a consequence of my experience there, but the thing I was the most proud of was a high buddy rating, and I think we could all agree that that's one of the wonderful things about military service, was the people that we served with. And when they give you their approval, that's a source of high satisfaction. I remember vividly being out on the train fire range for a week, qualifying with an M1. That was a series of weapons that we used, the M1, the carbine, 30 caliber machine gun. I fired expert with the M1. a fired expert with a carbine. And I remember particularly with a carbine firing, and I've heard, as we have all heard, athletes talk about being in a groove. I felt like I couldn't miss anything with that carbine that day. All I had to do was point it, and I'd hit the target. And I had a good day on the range and generally fired weapons well. The only weapon I couldn't fire very well was a .45, and I don't see how people use that weapon with any degree of success. You probably carried one, Jim, and you probably did too, mm-hmm. Frank, but good for you. I was pretty inept with them. The senior year, I was the brigade commander, which is the highest designation in ROTC. I was also commander of the local Scabbard and Blade organization, which was an honorary military leadership group. Basically, it consists of going down to the tap room after drill every Friday afternoon and ordering the first round, but I would take it for whatever it was worth. I was offered a regular Army commission, but a three-year commitment was not of any particular appeal to me, so I took the reserve commission. And in ROTC in those days, you had to fill out three choices. My first choice was the Intelligence Corps, second choice was armor, third choice was transportation. And because of the experience that I had, I was given the Intelligence Corps assignment and ended up a distinguished military graduate. So I had a good military experience, at least in terms of ROTC.
The reserve commission then was for 2 years, is that correct?
That's correct. There was a 2-year commitment and then a 4-year reserve commitment after that was over.
Okay. So then you graduated ROTC in 1964.
I was commissioned in June 1964.
Okay. And then where did you go from there?
I was assigned to, in those days, intelligence officers all went to Fort Benning initially. So that they would have infantry training. The perception was you can't possibly provide worthwhile information to troops on the ground unless you had some kind of understanding of what a commander's need was, a small unit leader's need was. And so I went to Fort Benning and started Infantry Officers Basic Number 5 in October of 1964. I was married and lived off post immediately outside Main Gate. I can't remember the name of the apartments, but they were pretty Spartan, as everything at Benning was. But I was in the active duty from October 1964 until I left in September 1966. I was at Benning from October 64 to January 64, having come from the Chicago area, not having any idea about what winter in the South was like. I made sure I brought plenty of Bermuda shorts and swimming trunks and didn't realize that Benning gets colder than a well digger's behind in January. We actually had snow on our tents when we went out to conduct some protracted operations at the far end of the reservation. So it was a plenty cold place. While I was at Fort Benning, I fired what we called then the new generation of weapons. That was the M14, the M79, and the M60 machine guns. The training was very good, I thought. I think one of the things that the military does best, and probably is given little credit for it, is their ability to train large numbers of people of a hugely diverse background and make them effective at a given mission in a remarkably short period of time. The training at Benning, both outside and the instructional training indoors, was really superb. And the infantry officers that conducted the training were highly motivated. They were good speakers. It was an eagerly sought out activity, I think, at least throughout my military experience. The training I had was really outstanding. You were always aware that the infantry thought it was the queen of battle. It was a highly motivated group of people with incredible esprit de corps. The training throughout seemed to be oriented toward conventional battle with the Russians. Vietnam was mentioned from time to time, but it wasn't mentioned from a standpoint of the idea that it would occupy a lot of the attention of the small unit leaders that Fenning was cranking out at the time. There was one indication that things were changing, though, in the sense that while I was there, they had an organization called the 11th Air Assault that I think, at least the story I was told, was they were created to develop the Army's first heliborne operational dictates, tactics, strategies, and things of that variety. And you certainly would know far better than I, Jim. But I know the place was lousy with helicopters. I think it was a division size unit, but I couldn't swear to that. But I do know that near the end of our training, we had three or four heliborne operations, which were, I thought, absolutely thrilling. I absolutely love being on those things and flying around in them. I think you must have had a kick being in a helicopter. But I understood that the 11th Air Assault, after I left, was sent to Vietnam with the patch of the 1st Cavalry Division, which prior to that had been in Korea, and they just swapped patches. That's a story I heard. I don't know if that's accurate or not. I went through all of the training at the infantry school. Near the very end, I was pulled out of class one day and asked to report to a captain, and he said, "I understand you speak Spanish." Well, in my statement of personal history, I had indicated that I'd taken Spanish because I had had 2 years of it in college, but I don't think I could order a meal on a Taco Bell. My proficiency of the language was really sketchy. Well, suffice it to say, at that point, the 82nd Airborne was their strategic reserve, and there was a military flap in the Dominican Republic. It came up in an awful hurry, and it had left in a hurry. But the 3rd Brigade, or the remaining brigade in the U.S. of the 82nd Airborne, was short of people in the intelligence unit, which was order of battle troops. So they gave me a hurry-up course in jump training. And by the time I was jump qualified, the flap was over and there was no need to go. So I continued on with my training. But if anybody ever tells you that airborne troops are 100% volunteers, at least there's one guy that was not an eager volunteer. I did what they told me. I did the 4 jumps, but I never picked it up after that. I then resumed my military education. Should I talk about the intelligence school? Is this blowing away?
Yeah, that sounds great.
I left Fort Benning and we drove up to Baltimore, which was the site of Fort Holabird, which at the time was the intelligence school. It was located in the Dundalk section of Baltimore, which is a little bit east of the city, bounded by the Dundalk River, a Colgate soap factory. There was a beer brewery down there also. So depending upon the direction of the wind, you always could read the weather predicated on the smells that would wash over the post. Fort Holabird was a stunning difference attitudinally. It was a world apart from what I was used to at Fort Benning. Benning being the home of the infantry school was the epicenter of all things military and right by the book. Fort Holabird was comfortable, relaxed. It was a campus-like atmosphere. They were beginning to phase us into a reality where the people that served in the intelligence corps, especially counterintelligence, were more mister to each other than they were corporal, lieutenant, captain, etc. And they were phasing into an environment, we were being phased into an environment where our behavior in a civilian context was an important thing to nourish and cultivate. Because the branch that I was going into was counterintelligence, and most of those people, if you had a continental United States posting, would be in a city or some location in the U.S. wearing civilian clothes, typically keeping office hours and driving an unmarked government car. And that's the direction in which I was headed. I went to Fort Holabird, arriving there starting in early February. I took the intelligence basic course, which lasted for 8 weeks, and then I took the intelligent agent course, which lasted for 12 weeks. I beg your pardon, 10 weeks. I ended in mid-June, and that was the period of time in which I was assigned to Fort Holabird. Holabird trained troops in order battle training. They trained positive intelligence people, that is, agent handlers and people that would be typically assigned overseas. My MOS was 9666, which was a counterintelligence MOS. And they also trained people for the Defense Against Methods of Sound course, which was the eavesdropping course, and the Defense Against Methods of Entry course, which was the lockpicking course. I talk a little bit about more about that later. The emphasis that we had on the in the initial course was generally talking about the history of the American intelligence activities in the Army. There was some mention of the CIA, but it was mostly focused at military intelligence. There was a great deal of talk about Russian border battle activities, Russian military capabilities. We would get lecturers who would show up without introductions. We were not told who they were and what they did, and they would wear civilian clothes as often as not and give us lectures about one phase or another of intelligence gathering operations, intelligence history, just a general oversight kind of situation. I have no idea where these people came from. And in the intelligence school, you moved into an environment where you just quit asking about things because you were authorized to know something. So instead of hearing, you can't know that, not authorized, blah, blah, you simply quit asking in many instances. And frankly, you were immersed with so much classified information, one couldn't remember what was classified, what wasn't classified, so you didn't tell anybody what you were doing. It was interesting training. It was eye-opening. There was a lot going on in the world that this particular second lieutenant didn't know anything about. And after the 8 weeks of the basic course, I went into the counterintelligence course. One of the most important things we had to learn was typing. And the woman that conducted the typing classes, and I think we had 16 hours of typing, was allegedly the holder of the world speed record in typing. Her name was Miss Klecka. I don't know why I remember that name, but it was.
How many words per minute could she type?
I have no idea, but it was blurring. You could almost see the heat come off that keyboard when she'd give us a little demonstration. But that's another good example of what the military could do, because all of us were kind of ham-fisted guys, and we were used to going through the intelligence school and or the infantry school, and all of a sudden here we are working on a typewriter. But that was a crucial skill to develop because we were going to be interviewers. That was what we were aimed at. That's primarily what we were designed to do. We spent hours and hours and hours developing interviewing skills so that when you talk to someone and you ask questions, you got a declarative answer instead of yes and no. They had actors who, in Baltimore, people who were professional actors that would come in and serve as subjects. And these people were really good because they'd honed their skills on hundreds of young second lieutenants and enlisted men on this whole process. So you get very good at what not to do with interviewing, and by the end you get pretty good at how to conduct an interview. We emphasized LIDMAC. It's the first of the acronyms that I guess I would spring on you. Loyalty, integrity, discretion, morals, and character. Those were the five variables that we had to absolutely emphasize, and the objective was to conduct a background investigation so that a security clearance could be granted to someone in the military. Clearly, all officers had to be top secret cleared at least, but a cook on a Nike site would have to have a top secret clearance or at least a secret clearance, especially if there were any kind of sophisticated weapons on the site. So the Army's need for background investigations was profound, and that was what the Army counterintelligence corps did with most of the time. I had exposure to lie detectors. They gave us a short course in the lockpick course, a short course in the bugging course. The inference was that if we ever got into a situation where we needed these kind of activities, that there were experts that would come to our back and call and respond and help us do whatever we had to do. But it was just basically to tell us what the Army was capable of doing, so that if we needed these strange skills, we'd be able to call on them. We did surveillance activities in downtown Baltimore, where the objects of the surveillance, they were called rabbits, were the officers and enlisted men training for the positive intelligence scores, the 9668 MOS, officer MOS, that were typically sent to Europe, where they would act as agent handlers. And typically these were people that had made a commitment to the Army. They were people that were going to be in for a significantly longer period of time than the two-year commitment that reservists make. To my knowledge, there were no reservists that took that course. These were all people that were at least first lieutenants or captains, men and men at that point. We had no women in our class that were all committed to the military.
How large were the classes?
The classes were probably 25 to 30 people. The senior officer in my class was a major. There were two majors, a sprinkling of captains, a few first lieutenants. These were typically guys that were lawyers that had gone to law school immediately after they graduated from ROTC and got commissioned and then went to law school. And by the time they did active duty, they'd already advanced one grade in pay and rank. And then lots and lots of second lieutenants. The intelligence school trained, the classes were by enlisted men and by officers. They were separate. The officers all trained as a group, the enlisted men all trained as a group, and there was very little interaction with enlisted men in a formal sense while we were at Holabird. Special forces troops were there. There were whole classes of special forces being trained in intelligence gathering and activities. So they were the people that you looked at with a special sense of awe, because they all seemed like they were about 6'6 and weighed 200 pounds and great-looking strapped troopers, as you would suspect. As I say, it was a relaxed campus-like atmosphere, especially after Benning. It was intense. And the emphasis was on security in all forms. There was a lot of information lying around, and you had to make sure that it was duly taken care of and locked down. And there was always that street legend that about the lieutenant in the class just before you that lost his security badge and was immediately shipped out to some god-awful post somewhere. I don't know if any of that's true, but I do know the intelligence school took security very, very seriously. We had Marine personnel. We had Navy personnel in my class as well. They never told us why they were there, and we learned at that point not to ask. We just enjoyed their company. No Saturday duty, which was very nice. They talked about the mysterious people in civilian clothes that would show up from time to time. Counterinsurgency at Holabird was rising in importance. You could almost see that somehow there had been a watershed that had taken place, I don't know, in that period of time, that maybe people concerned about activities in Southeast Asia figured they'd better start to download the heavy training requirements for a counterinsurgency type of training, and we began to get a lot more of that. I remember in some of the training there were Viet Cong uniforms and Viet Cong order of battle, and they began to talk a little bit about NVA, very little specifically about NVA. The thrust at that point was primarily the Viet Cong and an internal insurgency kind of war, as opposed to the war that it finally became. The people I met were extremely bright. The classes were segregated, as I mentioned. The enlisted men lived on post. There was limited BOQ space and very limited housing, so most of us lived off post. And it was a strange kind of world because we'd go home at night and watch television like everybody else and go out and drink beer on a weekend with and party with our friends and the people that we'd met there in our carpool. And yet we were going to class every day learning about what it took to become a counterintelligence officer. So that's my educational training. Near the end of it, they provide you with a dream sheet, as all of us will recall, and you got to pick where you wanted to go. I'd watched what was going on in Southeast Asia with a rising sense of concern, and I figured I didn't want to indicate I wanted to go anywhere overseas, so I told the Army I wanted to go either to Boston or San Francisco. They split the difference geographically and sent me home to Chicago, where I did my active duty. In terms of weaponry, we trained with a .32 caliber pistol. That was a standard weapon issued to people in the counterintelligence corps. .38 with a 2-inch barrel. Lunches consisted of a shooting pool with two guys that we'd gone to the basic intelligence course with, who had gone on to imagery interpretation. There was another signal that something was going on in Southeast Asia because they wouldn't tell us what they were looking at, but they would tease us with hints about the activities that they were looking at, they were involved with. And it's pretty clear that they were looking at imagery of Vietnam and maybe even North Vietnam at that point. Nothing was ever specifically said, but that was the inference.
Aerial photography,
that's correct. It was almost all photography. We had a little exposure to imagery interpretation. You got some radar, you got some infrared, but it was almost always imagery, photo interpretation, photo reconnaissance. It must have been some satellite, too, at that point, but it was never identified. Sources were never, ever mentioned. You just looked at it, and you just didn't ask where it came from. You got it. That was it. So that's my educational experience in the Army.
So then you got to do some practical use with your education.
After all the money the Army spent getting me trained, they figured they'd better get some use for me. So they sent me to Chicago. It was the 113th Intelligence Corps Group, Region 1. Region 1 consisted of Illinois, upstate, the entire state of Wisconsin, and a slice of northwest Indiana, Gary, Hammond, that area around the lake. That was Region 1. We were issued our badge and credentials. We were shown the badge, I should say. The colonel took the attitude that no damn fool second lieutenant was going to wander around with a badge in his possession. It was bad enough that we had credentials. He didn't need the badge. So the badge was put in the safe, and we never saw it again. But the credentials were our pass to get in to see people. They're the means of identifying who we were, and we were guarded with great intensity. They were a piece of heavy plastic, hard plastic, about 2.5 inches wide and maybe 4 inches long, and they came in a leather container with a transparent plastic piece of plastic over the front of it, and you flipped out your badge, or your credentials rather, to show people that you were legitimate in your presence and why you were asking all these questions. With regard to Region 1, the headquarters was located on Bryn Mawr Street on the northwest side of Chicago. I think it had been a former airborne artillery location. It was a typical Army one-story building, a lot of pale green paint, the kind of color scheme that we all came to know and love when we were in the Army in those days. The regional company commander was, or the regional CO rather, was Lieutenant Colonel. The XO was a major. There were three captains, about 12 lieutenants, and I guess 20 to 25 enlisted men. The senior EM was an E7. Everyone wore civilian clothes. Everyone kept generally office hours, although you were always on call when you were in the service, as you know. Headquarters was also the site of the main Chicago field office, so they did a lot of investigative work out of that office. There were resident offices in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and some of the location, and for the life of me, I can't remember where it was. It might have been Green Bay, but I'm a Bear fan, so I'm trying to suppress anything to do with the Packers. I know we had three offices in Chicago, and then we had one in Chicago. I beg your pardon. We had three offices in Wisconsin. We had two in Chicago. One, the Chicago field office, and then the Fifth Army field office, which was located on the south side of Chicago in the Hyde Park area. It was called Fifth Army because it was located in the Fifth Army headquarters building. It had nothing to do directly with Fifth Army. It just happened to be satellited on that space. The mission for Region 1 was to conduct background investigations upon which security clearances were based. We also did security sweeps of any military site to make sure that all classified information was secured, and taken care of, and properly disposed of and overseen. Absolutely. Nobody ever had a chance to get ready because that would defeat the purpose, but you're right. There was also a mission to do some security penetrations of the Lakeside Nike anti-aircraft sites. There were at least two on the lake, Lake Michigan. I think they were Nike Hercules, but they might have been Nike Zeus. I can't really remember. But I do know that one of the things that we would do periodically was test the security of these locations to make sure that they couldn't be penetrated. And we were able to do all kinds of dirty tricks to test this, presuming that if the bad guys wanted to penetrate it, they'd be at least as duplicitous as we were going to be. So that was something that we liked to do, and we used to do that from time to time. And finally, there was what I guess I would euphemistically call special operations, and that's anything that came our way, and I can talk a little bit about that going on, and I will. Everything we did was based on the information that we all provided in the Statement of Personal History, the SPH, and every one of us has filled out that. I can't remember DD form, whatever it was, but it was the basis on which all biographical information was recorded, and all officers and all enlisted men filled one of those out. And if a security clearance was required, the case would be broken up and sent down to the local area where the activities occurred. If someone went to school at Loyola University in Chicago, they'd check his education, sometimes her education, but it was still very much a masculine military establishment then. Just as an observation, we had a WAC captain give us instruction once at Holabird, and the class was so flummoxed we kept calling her sir. We just didn't occur to us that ma'am was the gender equivalent of sir. So that shows you the extent to which it was a masculine army at the time. Sure. We had very little exposure to women. Suffice to say, these cases would be broken down and scoped, was the phrase that was used, divided up according to where activities occurred. Typically, if a fella grew up in a neighborhood in Chicago, Hyde Park, he would have three listed character references that likely lived in that area, and we would interview those three character references to find out what kind of person he was. They would conduct a check on their financial circumstances, their banking activities, education. The local agency check is what we called it when you would go to the local police department to find out the extent to which they had any kind of a record with the local authority. The person that conducted that activity was a Department of the Army civilian that had been around forever, and he was well known to the Chicago Police Department in the best sense of the word, and he was a senior guy, so they would let him come and go and look at their files and do all that kind of stuff. That was not ever done by anybody that was a second lieutenant. He had those were much more senior people. So we would break down these cases. And my first job at Region 1 was to sit in a room that was about 20 feet wide, maybe 30 feet long, and there were desks all the way around the outside, and we would break down these cases according to the geography and assign the various pieces of the cases to the field office that would conduct the investigation. This was a pre-Xerox world, so all this information had to be hand-copied, and I can imagine all the mistakes that must have found their way into the system. And actually, I can remember the first Xerox machine we got assigned, and it was a manna from heaven, being able to, and all it did was make one copy at a time. And we thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. That was what I did for the summer of 1965. Each case had a suspense date on it. We had to fulfill the obligations by a certain time, and then it would be sent forward, and everything would be adjudicated somewhere else. The job of counterintelligence was not to assign a security clearance. The job of counterintelligence was to gather information. Someone would make an adjudication based on the information that was gathered, but that wasn't our job. We just gathered raw information and passed it forward. I stayed there until September 1965, when I was sent to the 5th Army Field Office as an agent. And I did background investigations out of that office until November 1965. The 5th Army Field Office conducted investigations for a geographical area that basically covered the entire south side of Chicago, all southern suburbs, all southwestern suburbs, and most of the western suburbs. So that is the span of activity that that we would have. And I covered a slice of Chicago that ran from the Chicago projects, the Henry Horner homes in the inner city, all the way west to Aurora, Illinois. One of the few times where a weapon would be issued was when investigations had to be conducted in the housing projects at night. And we did it at night because you could contact people. And so I would typically go with an Air Force intelligence guy. ASI? Is that right? I can't remember what Air Force called their. But he was a black first lieutenant, big, tall, handsome guy, dressed to the nines all the time, and we would meet, have dinner, and then we'd go into the projects and conduct background investigations. His clue was, tell people you're looking for so-and-so because you want to give them a good job. And that was the magic door. A lot of these people were earnest people. This was the draft, remember, and a lot of these young men were drafted into the Army, and they needed a security clearance to get ahead. It was a little bit of a sketchy environment because you did see people that gave you a hard look, because I certainly didn't look like most of the people that were there. But in company with my colleague from the Air Force, bless his heart, we all got this taken care of, and all of our activities were done with smoothness and clarity, and I never needed to use my .38 as though I would. I don't know what I'd do with it. We did train with the .38, by the way. We would go down to the firing range at the Customs House in downtown Chicago every month and fire until the colonel felt he'd either shot up enough ammunition or his agents could defend themselves if it ever came to that. November, I became Special Agent in Charge of the 5th Army Field Office. And boy, what a title. I felt absolutely great. A Special Agent in Charge. These were the days of Ephraim Zimbalist on the FBI, and he was a Special Agent. And here I was, 22 years old, a Special Agent in Charge of that 5th Army Field Office. I had a wonderful staff. My senior enlisted man was an E6. He'd been in the Army since at least 1951. His name was George Choi. He was a Korean-American and the kind of guy that that you hope you're going to get. You hope you're lucky enough to get when you're an officer. If you get any sense at all, you realize that enlisted men drive this process, and it's the strength of the military enlisted corps that has always determined what kind of a military we have, in my view. And my job is to make sure I took good care of Mr. Choi, because he was a wonderful, superb NCO, and he took awful good care of me. His work was always done to perfection. He was always the kind of gentle support that you would hope your senior NCO would give you. It was never, listen, stupid, which he could have said 1,000 times, but it was always, Mr. Yantis, don't you think it would be? So he was a wonderful guy and gave me all the support that I needed. I had an E-4, I had two E-2s that were right out of Fort Holabird, and everybody was Mr. I was Mr., they were Mr., and rank, we all knew what the rank was, but that didn't enter into it. There was an atmosphere of mutual respect that was a hallmark of the Intelligence Corps. And these were all people that tended to be volunteers. Draftees in the enlisted group were not as common in the Intelligence Corps. These were people that typically had volunteered to the service. I had two Department of the Army civilians. One was a RIFT major. His name was Ed Tobin. Chubby-faced, florid-jowled Irish guy who was from Chicago, and he knew a lot about the city, but particularly he knew politics. He was allegedly a friend of the Daley family. At least he knew an awful lot about the Daleys. And then I had another retired E-7 who was my other Department of the Army civilian. His name was Joe Lynch. And I never met a man who had a more encyclopedic geographic grasp of any place in the world than Joe Lynch did of Chicago. Case would come down, and I'd break it up and assign it to my agents, and I'd ask Joe where such and such an address on Pulaski Street was located, and he'd give me the next adjacent intersecting block coordinates, as it were. So he was a terrific guy to work for. They were all very motivated people. Our suspense dates were met with great regularity. Cases didn't get old and gray. FAFO was a good place to work, and we cranked out a lot of information. We did all counterintelligence investigations on the south side of Chicago, southwest side. I think I've already explained what the investigation consisted of. We generally got derived character references along with the listed character references, because that's how you would incorporate most of the time derogatory information. Someone's bound to list somebody that is going to say well of them, but if you ask, is there anyone else that knew Joe Dokes, you'd get a few names that maybe you didn't get the first time, and then you track those people down. You go through the same drill. Most cases were not derogatory. I would say there was maybe one case in 100 would contain derogatory information. But when a case did go derogatory, when you encountered a meaningful variance in the time to account for someone's time and their background, when they said they graduated and they didn't, when they said they had no financial problems and they did, when there might have been some questionable behavior of one type or another, then it would be assigned a derogatory category. And instead of having three derived character references, you might have eight or nine derived character references. You would instantly go into a two-man team configuration where investigations would be done together, because it was generally found to be very beneficial. If I were to go out, for instance, I would take Joe Lynch with me, because Joe was an E-7. He'd been in the Army since God was born. He'd done all this kind of stuff. When he was on active duty, he'd been involved in many derogatory investigations. So he would lead for a while and ask questions. I would lead for a while and ask questions. And notes would be taken furiously, and then you'd go back and type everything up. So derogatory information was what we were always on the lookout for, and there really wasn't very much of it. Security clearances came right on through, and a case would be turned over in about 2 weeks. If it went derogatory, it could take as much as 5 or 6 weeks. But you ran everything down. But again, no adjudication was done at local levels. It was always done somewhere else. And I couldn't even tell you where it was done. It was done somewhere in Washington or maybe Fort Holabird. I have no idea. But I do know that that was all done somewhere else.
Did word ever come back to you about specific individuals?
That's the worst part of being in the Intelligence Corps. It was this existential existence. You dealt with a fact situation, and it went away. And you never heard what the outcome was. Mm-hmm. It was like a guy that was a B-52 pilot that never got the benefit of seeing if he ever hit the target with any of his ordnance. It's just very frustrating. But the environment in which you lived, you
understood, accepted that.
Exactly. You understood that you would conduct your activity and generate the information required of you, and it would go off somewhere, and that was the end of it. And you'd never know. Now, once in a while, you'd get a follow-along request on a piece of information that you'd had something to do with. And it, when it would come back, it would be a little different. You could see a common address or some names you recognized from before, but it was all in your head because you kept no records. When a case left your desk, when it was done, it was gone. There was no case retained at a local level. All that information came down from somewhere and went back up to somewhere. The thrust of what we tried to do was tell people we're here to give you a good job, or we're here to give Joe Doakes a good job. We need to ask you a few questions. And that was the thing that opened up the door. And we interviewed all kinds of people. We interviewed people in projects. We interviewed people in politics, educators, military people. One of the most interesting ones that I did, and much of this was done on the telephone, I should say. And in this era, that seems impossible because you would want your bona fides established face-to-face these days. But that then, you could call up someone and say, I'm Bill Yantas, I'm with the Army Intelligence Corps, and I'd like to ask you a question about Joe Doakes. He's listed you as a character reference. Well, I made a call one day, and I talked to, I asked for someone named Fairfax Cone. I didn't know who Fairfax Cone was. Fairfax Cone was the founding partner of an advertising agency called Foot, Cone, and Belding. He was so important that Time magazine listed him and didn't even bother to identify what he did for a living. Yeah. He was just presumed that you knew who Fairfax Cone was. Foot, Cone, and Belding did Tony the Tiger and that kind of ad campaign. Well, anyhow, I got a hold of Mr. Cone, and he was as gracious as he could be. And I said, Mr. Cone, I'm looking into, we're doing a background investigation on Mr. Johnson. And I can't remember his first name, but it was Mr. Johnson. And we're trying to give Mr. Johnson a good job, and he listed you as a character reference. Well, I'll be happy to tell you about Mr. Johnson, blah, blah, blah. And finally I got to the point, I said, all of us have trouble from time to time paying our debts, Mr. Cone. Has Mr. Johnson ever been known to have difficulty paying his debts? And he paused, and he laughed a little bit, and he said, no. This is Johnson of Johnson Wax. He's a millionaire many times over. Well, that's the problem. When you just get a little slice of a case, you have no idea that Racine, Wisconsin's involved. And so I had a little egg on my face, but you dealt with all kinds of people, and you recovered pretty quickly, and Mr. Fairfax Cone was very gracious in what he did. We did investigations of the projects. I told you about that. Those were the most dangerous. We did penetration attempts of the Nike sites where we would actually manufacture credentials from the Chicago Tribune, for instance, and say we were writing a story about how these anti-aircraft batteries protected the lakefront and what they could do and their capabilities. And I was actually able to talk a battery commander into lifting one of those birds up out of the pit at one point, and then you identify who you are and the color drains from his face, and you hope you can get out of that battery with in one piece. It was uncomfortable, but it was the kind of thing that you necessarily have to do. We did special operations from time to time. That would involve surveillance. We never knew why we were doing it. As I indicated earlier, you just got a little slice, a little piece of something. And all I was told was, so-and-so lives at such and such an address, and you need to conduct some kind of surveillance. It might be a close surveillance. It might be a discreet surveillance. But some kind of surveillance activity might be necessary. And you would hand off this particular target to your successor. Sometimes we would be known to rent property across the street from a target to observe that particular individual, never knowing why we had to do it, but we knew we did. At one point, we conducted a surveillance on an American who was extremely famous, and it's a man that you would know instantly without even hesitation, who had a very prominent role to play in American social and political history. And he had come to Chicago for a specific purpose. The Army was concerned that his presence might trigger the use of National Guard or regular army troops. So our job was to begin to follow his patterns so that we could recognize the people he interacted with, where he went, what he did, so that if regular troops or National Guard troops ever had to become involved in the situation for any reason, then we would be able to convey that information to people that might have to do something with it. It sounds more suspicious than it was. It sounds more ominous than it was. The intention was to generate information so that appropriate military authority could act effectively given civilian oversight. I don't mean to be obscure, but I don't know how much of this is disclosable. So I'll continue to speak generally. Suffice to say, as years went by, we begin to see much more talk about civilian surveillance by military activities. And I can see where it came from. And it may have shifted into a more nefarious kind of behavior, but there was a great sense of innocence about all this when it all started. And I think this was some of the start of it. We also got involved with riots. Those were the summers where parts of American cities would erupt. And if the Guard was going to get called out, or especially federal troops, they had to know what was going on. So the minute there would be any kind of activity, we'd go on 24-hour round-the-clock behaviors. And we all would gather at Region 1, and all behaviors would emanate from our regional headquarters. We would go out in jeeps with the Guard troops and watch what they did, see where they went, so that if the 82nd or the 101st got involved, that they would have sufficient information so that they could fulfill their mission. No federal troops are ever necessary. The Guard always took care of things within an unlimited period of time. Let's see. Black Muslim encounters. The South Side had a growing community of black Muslims, and we had standing orders that when our agents would knock on the door, if a woman dressed in Muslim garb were to come to the door, or some man who was obviously a black Muslim, we would stop the investigation at that point, apologize for the intrusion, and leave. The Army bent over backwards to avoid the instigation or the appearance of an instigation of any kind of activity or incident. They were especially sensitive about Muslims for some reason. We got lots and lots of discussions about that. Colonel Pattis was the, I think it was PADDIS, was the lieutenant colonel who was the head of Region 1. A rumor was that he was the former head of the military mission to the country of Greece, and a personal acquaintance of King Peter, I guess it was. But again, there were lots of rumors in the service, and you never knew exactly what you were dealing with. We would do... am I going on too long? I can turn this down.
No, keep going.
We did... If you qualified your statement of personal history, if you refused to answer, which was sometimes done by people who got drafted, particularly people who went to the University of Chicago. I had an E-4 that would come down, and then they would have to do a special investigation. And there are a few guys in the Army that I admired more than him. His name was Norris, and he came from Millstone, West Virginia, tiny little town. He was just as country as he could be, but he was the essence of a professional man. These guys would heap scorn on him and talk about the military-industrial complex and killing babies and all the rest of this stuff. And good old Mr. Norris just was professional, and he would ask his questions. He'd do what he had to do. He volunteered for Vietnam, and I saw him last sometime about 3 months before I got out. I told you about what happens when cases went derogatory. If a case went serious, And something really meaningful happened. There was a unit in Washington, I think called the 902nd Intelligence Corps Group, and they're the ones that were the lifelong professionals. These were men that, maybe some women, but men who had made a commitment to the Army Intelligence Corps, were going to be there forever. When they were in the U.S., they were counterintelligence. When they would go overseas, they were 9668s, rather, acting as agent handlers, building nets, gathering the information overseas. So when something really went bad, we'd call in the 902nd, and then we'd step out of the picture, and again, never know what took place. One of the most mysterious things that ever happened to me was I noticed when I'd open up my desk, there'd be a clang at the back of it, and the writing pad. It was one of those metal military desks we've all seen. And after a few clangs, it occurred to me it wasn't something underneath that was hitting it. So I was sitting there one day with not much better to do, and I took a screwdriver and took my desk apart. And in the back of the slide where you writing pad that comes out, mm-hmm. it would go all the way back. In the back of it, there was a glass paperweight that had been deliberately put in the back so you couldn't close it all the way. And there was a tiny canister of Minox film. Minox films were the tiny little cameras at the time that agents used. They were about an inch wide and about 4 inches long, and they were tiny little things, and James Bond used them and all that kind of spy stuff. It was a can of Minox film, and I couldn't be more surprised if there'd have been a howitzer inside that thing. So I took it out. I instantly called headquarters and spoke to the colonel. He said, put whatever it is in an envelope and hand carry it up to me. Don't look inside that thing. Don't do anything with it. I didn't. I took it to the colonel. A month later, three guys came into my office. They all identified themselves as being from the 902nd in Washington, and they asked me questions for about 20 minutes until they were satisfied that my motives were pure. I was absolutely innocent. I was just a nosy SOB that had been poking around and found this can of film. And so I don't know what it was. But again, it was one of those mysterious things that happened. And
you don't know how it got there.
I don't know how it got there. I don't know what it was. I don't know what they did with it. It may have been nothing, but I wondered about that all these years. Mm-hmm. Vietnam was mentioned. We committed troops to Vietnam in the summer of 1965. I think that was the 1st Division. And from that point forward, Vietnam was very much on everybody's mind. Mm-hmm. We were pretty certain that anybody out in the region was not going to go. They were going to come from the schools or going to come from a unit that was being sent as a group, and they weren't going to send the 113th. But Vietnam became very, very serious, and we began to get people that had been to Vietnam, that were going to go back to Vietnam, and it cast a very long shadow over the military in the U.S. I will always regret that there's something about me that always feels a sense of being unfulfilled. You went to Vietnam, and you were associated with that conflict. It was the watershed event of our lives, and I did what I was supposed to do, and I volunteered, and I was glad to be in the Army, and I was glad to leave the Army. I did my 2 years, and I was proud to have done it. I got a very high rating when I left, and I had no reserve time to serve because the intelligence corps is a small group. And they had lots of rank, people that stayed in and did the reserves.
Well, you had a very important job to do.
I guess that's right.
Yes.
But you know, I will always feel that something really unfulfilled about not having that experience. I feel like it should have been. Mm-hmm. I didn't volunteer, so I must not have felt it too much at the time. But my hat's off to those that did serve and did what they did, and you all did under the circumstances.
Awesome.
Okay.